in our minds, we have this notion that correct and creative are mutually exclusive. And if we can break that in our minds, we're on the path. In other words, I can sit down and play a Chopin nocturne exactly as written, but I can also improvise freely over the left hand. And they're not mutually exclusive. Actually, the ability to improvise freely over the left hand gives me a great deal of understanding and respect for the beauty of Chopin's written melody. So the kind of approach you're talking about with your students is exactly what I recommend to develop the understanding to be not only an interpreter, but a composer.
Welcome to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast, the place where teachers from around the world meet to share innovative ideas about music education. Listen and learn as we help you motivate your students, grow your income, expand your studio, and become a more creative piano teacher.
G'day everyone, and welcome back to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. You're listening to episode 104. And if you're one of my Inner Circle Piano Teaching community members, a very special welcome to you. My name is Tim Topham, your host for the show. And if this is your first time here, thank you so much for tuning in. I definitely recommend that you subscribe because we have lots of awesome content coming up as we finish up our composition month and move into group teaching. The Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is a place where you can get weekly inspiration, ideas, business, and teaching strategies to help support your teaching and grow your studio. And remember that the best place to listen to podcasts like this is on your phone or tablet as you drive, cook, exercise, walk the dog, whatever you're doing. If you're sitting at a computer watching this, I would recommend that you could be doing other things at the same time. It's the best way to absorb podcasts. So to do that, head to the podcast app on your phone, search for Creative Piano and subscribe, and you'll automatically be notified when new episodes go live. And thanks to everyone who has left reviews on Facebook and iTunes recently. I really appreciate all your feedback. Find out how you too can support the work I'm doing by leaving a review. You can head to timtopham.com/review to find out the process. It's very quick and easy, and I'll give you the steps there. Today's show notes and a full transcript, as usual, are going to be available at timtopham.com/episode104. And just before we dive into this week's episode, I want to take this opportunity to let you know that the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast is brought to you by The Inner Circle, the world's leading professional development and training community for piano teachers. Inner Circle members get access to an extensive library of courses, teaching videos, lesson plans, and downloads that cover everything you need to know, not only to teach piano creatively and inspire students of all ages and abilities, but also to support you in building and growing your studio. On top of that, you also get access to our monthly online masterminds, exclusive member discounts on products, services, software, and sheet music, plus our active community forums where you not only get advice and input from me, but also from hundreds of fellow piano teachers and my handpicked team of experts from around the world. So if you are serious about expanding your teaching repertoire, learning the best strategies to motivate and inspire students while growing a thriving studio, the Inner Circle is the place to be. Find out more at timtopham.com/community. And use the code PIANOPODCAST, one word, to take $100 off an annual subscription locked in for the life of your membership. Just before we get started with today's episode, I wanted to let you know about a great little download that we've created especially for the content from this recording. And it's to do with the topic that we're discussing, which is all around an approach to creative teaching, which our guest has called the Four Musical Arts. And so our download is a really beautifully designed reference that you could have on the piano or in your teaching studio to remind you of these four main areas that we're going to be discussing in today's podcast. Make sure you check it out and grab your own copy at timtopham.com/104, which is, of course, the show notes page where you'll be able to access all the other links and a transcript. So today's episode is all about teaching music creatively. It's what I'm all about, but I'm by no means the only exponent of this approach around the world. My guest on the show today is one of the pioneers of a more creative approach to teaching piano. He's a pianist, educator, and the author of the Pattern Play series on improvisation. He also wrote the new Create First series and the Chord Play books on the art of arranging. He travels the world helping others make music education more enjoyable and creative. Welcome to the show, Forrest Kinney.
Thank you for having me.
An absolute pleasure, and especially given the fact that you're actually on a holiday while we record this. So thank you very much for giving me some of your holiday time.
Oh, you bet. I might be talking a bit slower, but other than that, you're getting me.
Forrest is about the most chilled I've ever seen him look, so it's good to see you've been recharging, because no doubt you have a massive fall semester coming up. Tell us a little bit about what you'll be doing in the next few months.
Well, I'm going to be going to Idaho, New Hampshire, Boston, Vancouver, Portland, and giving concerts and giving presentations on various aspects of creativity and, you know, my usual thing.
Right. And by concerts, do you mean you're performing other people's work, or is it improvisationary?
No, actually, like in a few weeks at the Idaho Music Teachers Conference, I'll be doing one of my four arts concerts. Now, I did one in California last month with a vocalist, and the four arts concerts actually involved me improvising in various ways and styles, and then arranging and doing a variety of different kinds of arranging, and then playing some of my own compositions. And finally, the fourth art is the art of interpreting. And so there I play, like next month, I'll be playing a Chopin Nocturne and a piece by Gershwin, and talking about how that can be done in an artful way.
Sounds much more like what our great composers did in their day to perform.
Exactly.
What we do today.
Exactly.
Right? And we're going to talk more about that today, right?
Yeah, it all shifted radically in the middle of the 19th century. But yeah, prior to 1850 or so, people performed their own compositions, their own arrangements, and their own improvisations.
We need to definitely get back to that. And I'm going to read out in just a minute a fantastic short article that Forrest wrote in one of the piano teaching Facebook groups, because it sets the scene for what we're talking about today really well. Just before I do that, though, Forrest, with all that traveling and presenting, are you getting any time to teach this second half of the year, or is that on the back burner for now?
You know, I'm actually in the middle of a sabbatical. I've taught for 40 years, a lot of private lessons, and I just thought about a year ago I need to take some time off to write the new Create First series and work on some other personal projects and get back to composing. And I thought, you know, I'm going to live off savings for a year or two and do that. So right now I'm actually not private teaching for the first time in about, 25 years.
And how are you coping? Or are you quite enjoying it?
You know, I miss the personal contact with people, but it is nice to wake up in the morning. It's an enviable position to wake up and think, I've got the entire day free. What am I going to do? Not a lot of people can say that. So.
Yeah. Do you see yourself getting back into a more structured teaching in the future, or do you think you'll kind of continue what you're doing now?
I'm not sure yet. Probably a blend of both. As I say, I miss the sense of watching kids grow up and helping them through those years. But I do feel like I've got a mission, and teachers are responding, and they keep inviting me to come. And as long as people keep inviting me, I'll prioritize teaching teachers. So I would guess it would be 2/3 doing what I'm doing now and about 1/3 of the time going back to private teaching.
Yeah, sounds like a similar take on it that I have. If I can teach other teachers how to do things, then I'm going to impact a whole lot more students in the end, right?
Exactly. That's the way I think too.
So let's start. I'm going to read out this post. You titled it The Traditional Teacher and didn't say much more about it and just went straight into it. So this is in Forrest's own words from his Facebook post. I'm writing to offer encouraging words to colleagues who may be wishing to make changes in the ways they teach but are hesitant to do so. I'd like to give my perspective after 40 years of teaching. As a teenager, I was taught by two fine classical teachers to perform a wide range of literature, play scales and arpeggios, and study music theory in books. I learned to play Bach fugues and Chopin preludes by memory, write chorales, and follow the rules, in inverted commas, of four-part writing, and play all the harmonic minor scales with a metronome. And so this is mostly what I taught for the first decade of my career. As I tried to make a living as a musician, I discovered that while my training had prepared me to present a classical recital, it did not prepare me to play contemporary music at social engagements, work in churches, play in bands, play on cruise ships, make arrangements for students, play tunes by ear, read lead sheets, and so on. And so over decades, I've learned all these skills, some from an excellent jazz teacher, some from books, but mostly from trial and ear. And I was able to make a living as a pianist. When doing research for a book I'm writing, I learnt that Bach trained his students to do these kinds of things, except play on cruise ships, of course. According to his son, he taught students figured bass, the lead sheet of the day, near the beginning, and his students learned to improvise, arrange, and compose. He was preparing his students to be working musicians in the community. To give an example, at the audition for the organist position at a church in Hamburg in 1725, the keyboardist was required to do six different things. Five of them had to do with improvisation in various forms. And so over the past 40 years, I have gone back to Bach while keeping the best of what I now call the 19th century performer model. I teach my students to improvise, read lead sheets, understand harmony, arrange music, compose and write songs, and play and perform literature. I call this the four arts model. These changes happened slowly over the last 40 years. If you want to help your students improvise, arrange, and compose, and learn yourself how to do it, you are not breaking tradition. On the contrary, you are rediscovering a much longer tradition that was swept aside in the 19th century. You are not leaving tradition, but deepening it. Lovely words from Forrest there. And I've always said that the great composers whose music we spend so many hours perfecting and memorizing were amazing improvisers and arrangers. So it was really good to read that because I wholeheartedly agree. Why have we moved so far away from these roots of music making?
You know, that's one of the reasons I'm on sabbatical is I really have wanted to write a book that answers that question because I've been asking that question for 30 years. And it's quite a whodunit. I mean, you know, the usual suspects, people point to Franz Liszt or Clara Schumann, but actually I'm pointing the finger these days at Felix Mendelssohn. You know, there's lots of players. What happened was a huge shift in the mentality of people in the 19th century, largely caused by the infusion of printed scores into a marketplace. Prior to the 1800s, you didn't really have printed music. For example, Bach's Well-Tempered Clavier wasn't printed until the year 1800. Everything was done by hand, by manuscript. But suddenly you had a market for music, you had publishers spewing out all these printed scores, and it created what I call a hyper-literalism, where people became very literal about music should be this way. Beethoven wrote this note this way, and I must do it. And it has to do with the visual impression of the printed score and all sorts of things. Prior to that, though, as you say, they were all improvisers. From Bach to Bartok, they were all master improvisers. And so I can't really summarize too quickly. It's going to take me a book to answer that question. But I will say for right now, just think of it as mostly involved with print and all the associated attitudes that went with it. I'll mention one other thing, Felix Mendelssohn, a master improviser like all of them were, but he hated to improvise in public, absolutely hated it. He thought it was degrading. He thought it was just showy, kind of a circus clown sort of thing. And there's a lot on record of him writing letters to people saying, oh, I'll never improvise in public again. And he started a conservatory in Leipzig in the middle of the 19th century, which had a profound influence on music culture. And there's about 1,500 people who came from the U.S. and Canada, for example, who studied at the Leipzig Conservatory over the next 50 years or so. And they took Mendelssohn's attitude back to Oberlin, all these other conservatories, this attitude that the musician was not an improviser, the musician was a performer of other people's music. And that was the huge change in the 19th century that pretty much altered pedagogy up until our times. And people like you and I are fighting hard to remind people, hey, before all these scores became available, people were improvisers. They were arrangers. They were composers. So I like to say that you and I are simply trying to recover what was lost in that kind of performer frenzy of the 19th century.
You broke up right at the end there. Lost in the performance-centric, is that what you said?
I would say the emphasis on the performer, or what it is, it's a musician as an actor. That was kind of the concept, is that Beethoven was to music like Shakespeare was to language. You had these master performers and writers. And so you had this culture of musical actors that came along to resurrect and interpret these master works. And it's a very important part of being a musician. But I like to remind people, and you do too, that it's really just one part of being a musician.
I try it. I interestingly enough, I always thought that Liszt was to blame, being the showy performer that he was, and apparently the person that really developed the concept of the solo recital from memory. I think maybe we have the crazy expectations of memorization from Liszt, perhaps. I wasn't aware of the printing connection and Mendelssohn, so that's good to know about. I'm definitely going to be interested in this book when you finish writing it.
Yeah, when I'm finished writing it. Liszt gave the first solo piano concert in 1839, and you're right, he was the first to perform by memory, and he was the template of what it meant to be a pianist in the 19th century. But I don't really blame him, much like you can't blame Elvis for the tens of thousands of Elvis impersonators. It was more of the zeitgeist of the time, where everybody just wanted to play these masterworks. And so, but yeah, Felix Mendelssohn, Robert Schumann had a big part in the shift of attitude. Clara Schumann had a huge part in the shift. So I'll go and discuss these various suspects in my book when it comes out someday.
Right. And this, there isn't a set date for this. This is just a work in progress.
Yeah, it's a hobby at this point. I mean, a book like this is a labor of love. So it might take 3 years. If I decide to make it appeal to academics, it might take twice as long, because then I have to do all the footnotes and careful research and go away from my anecdotal writing style.
That's right. Now, before we get into your four arts approach, which I want to talk about in a moment, I had an interesting conversation with a friend and colleague at NCKP about creativity and whether teaching performance in interpretation is creative in its own right. And his view is that his teaching is creative, even though he doesn't sort of do improvising and that kind of stuff, because the way in which he works in interpreting a score and dynamics and style and stuff is creative. Is that your take on the word creativity and how we're using it, or does it mean something different to you?
Yes and no. I absolutely agree that the art of interpreting can be enormously creative. I mean, to me, there's no doubt about it. When I'm interpreting a piece by Chopin, it feels very much like an improvisation. And every time it's different. And in that sense, it's a real fine art. The problem is that for most people, the way they're taught, it really doesn't become an art. For example, many of us were taught to play the notes correctly, with the correct fingering, with the correct key signature, in the correct time, with the correct pedaling. And when we get all that, the teacher breathes a sigh of relief because we sound like music and we go on to the next piece. But actually, in that process of correcting, there's not really any creativity. The creativity happens when the piece is internalized to such a point that one can play it differently every time. And that doesn't really happen for very many musicians. So that's where I would agree with that colleague very much, that interpreting is an art. But I would also disagree, because I feel we need to remind ourselves that the process of reading and playing music can be done without any creativity at all.
Right. Yeah. And I think you say that interpreting Chopin for you is an incredibly creative experience, and you don't play it the same way twice. I think you would be the absolute exception, of course, because, again, going back to what you were saying before, most of us are taught that Chopin should be played in a particular way, and that's how we expect our students to play. We'll demonstrate it. They copy it. It's right or wrong. And, of course,
that kind of interpretation is not so
creative, I don't think.
Well, right. But what's so ironic about that is Chopin never played his music the same way twice. It's a famous anecdote about he played at a party and played one of his nocturnes, and the people in the audience said, "Oh, maestro, could you play that again?" And he said, "Oh, sure, after my break, I will." So he comes out after his break and plays this piece. And, you know, people enjoyed it and they applauded, but they said afterward, "Oh, maestro, it would have been nice to hear the first piece again." And he says, "Oh, it was the first piece again." I mean, the man was a master improviser. And actually, if you read Pablo Casals' book, or Glenn Gould or Horowitz, they're always saying the secret of their art is that they play it differently each time. And that's what makes it creative. If it's played the same every time, then it's done mechanically, and a robot is the opposite of an artist.
Right.
So we need to actually teach in a way what I call creative practicing that encourages people to play a piece in or practice it in such a way that it becomes very free when you play it. It becomes open to the moment.
And audiences would then have to accept that that's what might come out, though, of course, because people are, again, attuned that, you know, Beethoven should be performed in a particular classical style. So if someone reinterprets it differently, that can throw a lot of people offside.
Well, but here's the interesting assumption in that. You're bringing up the audience, which, again, is that 19th century way of thinking where the musician is an actor playing for an audience. But if we look at it in a radical sense, radical meaning like the word radish, going back to the roots, we're not really playing for an audience. We're playing for our own creative spirit. And so if I play a Beethoven piece differently and it's a lot louder than, quote, it's marked, that's how I felt it that day. And, of course, people like Glenn Gould, who did things like that, who were incredible artists, are panned. Right, by the intelligentsia, because he's not following the script. But what he would do often is he would practice a piece and then not play it for a month and then go into the recording studio. I mean, he had the kind of technique he could do that. And then it would come out totally fresh and unexpected. But again, that's creativity.
Right. Yep. I tend to agree. So there you go. And I try, and if I'm teaching a written score to students, ask them far more than I tell them, you know, how would it sound if we played this bit louder, or if we do the opposite of the crescendo there and we decrescendo and we add an accent at the end and we don't phrase that properly. Those kind of questions and that experience for students, I think, is a simple way to dip your toe in this water of not being quite so rigid. Would you agree?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I always make the point that in our minds, we have this notion that correct and creative are mutually exclusive. And if we can break that in our minds, we're on the path. In other words, I can sit down and play a Chopin nocturne exactly as written, but I can also improvise freely over the left hand. And they're not mutually exclusive. Actually, the ability to improvise freely over the left hand gives me a great deal of understanding and respect for the beauty of Chopin's written melody. So the kind of approach you're talking about with your students is exactly what I recommend to develop the understanding to be not only an interpreter, but a composer.
I love it. And you can do that with most any music, particularly if it's got a repetitive left hand of some sort. To keep that left hand going and just explore some very simple improvisation with the right hand, with students, it doesn't have to be jazz. It can be any style, really, as long as you know the note set that's going to sound kind of okay. Go with it. I would encourage any teacher to do that. So exactly. tell us a little bit about your four arts approach, because I think it's a great way to summarize everything that you're about, and I really love how you've wrapped it into this concept.
I think all of us, when we're teaching, we're kind of guided by a model. And for the first 10 years I taught, my model was I needed to teach two contrasting pieces, different styles. I needed to do technique in every lesson. I needed to do sight reading in every lesson. And that was kind of my model. It's what I would call the performer model. But now I have this four arts model. So when a student walks in the door, okay, let's improvise together. So usually we start by improvising a duet together, and then we explore maybe what they've been improvising this week. So there's art number one. Then with all my students, I'd like to help them understand how to arrange. Now, a lot of people don't understand, or, well, I should say it this way. I make a distinction between improvising and arranging that a lot of people don't make. When I sit down to play, say, somewhere over the rainbow, and then I improvise on it, I'm actually combining two arts. I've made an arrangement of the piece, but on the repeat, I'm freely improvising. That's the way improv was always taught. It was taught on the foundation of arranging. People were taught figured bass, they were taught harmonization, they were taught tunes. Then on the repeats, you would improvise. What I do in my teaching is I separate improvising and arranging. I teach improv from the very first lesson using patterns. People don't need tunes, don't need harmony, they don't need chord understanding, they don't need lead sheets. It's basically the teacher plays a pattern and they invite the student to play with me on black keys or play with me on white keys. So even in the first lesson, we can do improv. Now, in terms of arranging in the first lesson, we start learning tunes by ear, not by rote, not by sight, but cultivating the ear. And then the third art is composing. Now, that I don't really focus on so much in the first lesson. I feel like that grows naturally out of improvising and arranging. And then the fourth art is the art we talked about earlier, the art of interpreting. And that's, again, grows later. So actually, with my beginning students, I focus much more on the arts of improvising and arranging before I even teach reading. And this is just like the way Clara Schumann was taught. When she was five, her father taught her to play tunes by ear, transpose, modulate, improvise. And only after 10 months did he teach her to read the treble clef. And then 2 months later, he taught her to read the bass clef. So in a nutshell, that's the four arts model: improvising, arranging, composing, and interpreting. And sometimes composing means songwriting.
And it sounds like there's somewhat of a continuum from, I actually just wrote this on my page in four quadrants: improv at the top left, arranging, composing, bottom right, interpreting. And then I wrote an arrow going clockwise around, because it seems like the improvising leads on to arranging. When you settle on an improvisation, that kind of creates a composition. And then that is the hardest connection, I think, to make for people would be the connection between all that composing and improvising and the interpreting, because that seems like a completely different thing. How do you get that connection linked up?
You know, the analogy with language is just unbeatable. Improvising is exactly what you and I are doing right now. We're not talking by a script. I don't think you have a script, do you? Because I don't.
No.
No. So this is improvising. Then arranging is comparable to storytelling. That's where you take a known theme, like let's say someone says, tell me the story of Santa Claus. And so I'll tell the story of Santa Claus or some more specific story or a joke that I've heard. That's also arranging. Composing is writing a musical essay. It's writing your ideas down, developing them, maybe publishing them. So then interpreting is basically taking somebody else's composition and bringing it to life. That is acting it on a stage or reading it aloud. So to me, it's exactly as you described, that nice continuum around the circle, because then interpreting and composing, the two literate arts, really inform improvising and arranging, the two non-literate arts, and make them bigger and more diverse. Because the danger of just being an ear player is that you get stuck in ruts. And I think we've all heard the great ear player who plays one piece and sounds great and plays a second piece and it sounds the same. Plays the third piece and wow, it's the same style. But people who are literate have this broad sense of style that's attained through studying literature. So that's why I feel like all four arts feed one another and are vital in and of themselves.
I like it. And if you had an hour with an intermediate level student, would you tend to split the lesson into approximately for those four quadrants, 15 minutes each? I know you wouldn't be so strict about it, but is that the kind of way you teach?
I try to aim for four, you know, all four arts. And believe me, I don't do it with every student, but I can think of a number in the last few years that I had attained that with. Like one girl named Angeline, we'd always start off with improvising, and that usually didn't take more than 5 minutes because basically I'll improvise with them, then I'll open up the pattern play book or the create first book, and I'll say, okay, try this pattern this week, and then I send them off. Arranging takes more time. Now, with Angeline, we worked on accompanying skills because she is a vocalist. And for the composing part, we did songwriting, as you might guess. And then we spent half the lesson on literature because she was really into classical literature. And my basic premise there is I like to do two pieces, one that challenges the student technically and one that's easy technically but challenges them musically. So it tends to be more like half the time on literature and half the time on other stuff. But again, it varies completely with the student.
Understood. Yeah. I get asked a lot about how to break up lessons, how to structure the average lesson. And so I'm thinking of, I might even put this together in a little bit of a diagram because I've been drawing as you've been speaking. It works together so well. I've got some questions of you to give some teachers tips because we don't often get the chance to hang out with you like this. So I want to pick your brains on a few things. So I've got a few questions that I've thought about. For students, and often teenagers I think fall into this category, who only want to play by ear and learn on YouTube, how do we best deal with them and educate them?
Yeah, it's the big question, isn't it? I have totally changed over the last 40 years because I was trained by a Juilliard graduate. And basically, the model was the teacher was the dictator. The teacher had the program, wrote out the lesson plan, and you followed it. And if you didn't, boy, you were in trouble. But over the last 40 years, particularly as I've taught more creativity, I've discovered that what really works with creative people is engaging their passion, engaging that thing that they're compelled to do. And so I had a dude named Noah who is exactly what you just described. And he wanted to play Beatles songs. Now he's 12 years old and he just was fascinated with the Beatles. So, but he quickly discovered that there was a limit to his ear. So I got him a Beatles fake book and taught him to read treble clef, started teaching him about the world of chords. And of course, this was a doorway for him into his interest. And so he learned to read treble clef. He started understanding all these chords because, you know, the Beatles use actually augmented chords and some very odd harmonies.
Yeah.
And I stuck with that passion for a year and a half. And he became a pretty good piano player, a decent reader of treble clef. Then one day, a friend played Moonlight Sonata. He's like, I've got to play the piece. And, well, of course, but you got to learn to read bass clef. Now, I wouldn't advise teaching most students to read, you know, in C sharp minor, but that's the way I tend to go with these very creative kids is I work with them on their passion until they see the limitations of their skill set. And there comes a day when they say, oh my gosh, I've got to play for release. I've got to do this. And I say, you know, it's time for you to read, don't you think? And they read quite quickly at that point because A, they see the necessity, and B, they've got the kind of playing skill set that allows them to read quickly.
Yep, they've got a purpose suddenly. I have the same experience with students who I might get who are transfer students. I've ended up with quite a few transfer students whose parents bring them to me because they're about to quit and they need a bit of a hook in, and my hook in is some chords and pop music that they want to play. But it's it doesn't surprise me anymore because I'm used to it, but it used to surprise me that after a few weeks of that, they would start to go, I heard this classical piece or I'd really want to play this. And it leads beautifully into more reading, understanding written music, all that kind of stuff. It's surprising how, and you did the same thing with Noah, hooking him in with the Beatles and teaching him along the way then gets him into that point of being 100% motivated to take it to the next step rather than from the beginning saying, right, let's read music.
That's it, because Noah would have walked away like he had done from his previous teacher because he came to me for the same reason students come to you. And I think we inherited a kind of a highbrow attitude from the 19th century that there is the high music and the low music. But you know, that is a modern attitude. Brahms, for example, made his living as a youth playing dance music. And after his first symphony was published, he walks into a pub and the woman says, oh, maestro, play some dance music for us. And so he sits down and plays dance music for an hour. And I think it's important to keep in mind that what we really want our students to have is a lifelong love of music. And this means there'll be periods of their life, they'll be really into reading. Periods of their life, they'll be really into composing or improvising. And the creative life doesn't usually follow this straight road. It's a very curvy, bendy road.
Right. 100% agree with that. All right. So another question. What about for students who are terrified of improvising or who just won't do it or don't enjoy it or say they don't enjoy it? How do you approach them?
Yeah. Usually those are the students who've been trained for a number of years, because they have learned that it's all about playing the correct notes. And so suddenly, when they are thrust into a position where they don't know what's correct or incorrect, their entire compass is thrown out and they get a sense of vertigo and panic. So, but the thing is those students need it more than anybody, because they're usually the ones who are perfectionists and have the real phobia about performing. And so what I usually do is I start playing a very rich sounding accompaniment from one of my books, and I'll just say, you know, make a sound with me on black keys. And I'll play a black key and I say, hey, start with this note. I give them a starting note just to, you know, let them know that the water's not too cold. And so I say, play that in any rhythm you like. And so what you're doing is creating an environment that sounds rich and creating a scenario in which they can't fail. And then they start playing that note. And then you say, hey, try another black key. Just try it. See what it sounds like, or hear what it sounds like. And they try that. And pretty soon they're discovering that, oh, I'm in a world where I don't have to be correct. I can explore. I can discover. So it's tricking them by creating this rich environment. So it's all about duet playing.
And I like that idea of fail-proof, effectively, situation. So they can't play a wrong note.
Yeah. Oh, and that's nice. I think I said foolproof, but actually fail-proof is much. We've just coined a new word together. Excellent. I like
fail-proof creativity. I love it. Many of your accompaniments are exactly that. You show teachers the note set to use for the student, and you show them what to play. So really on both ends of the scale, student and teacher, it's foolproof or fail-proof.
Fail-proof. Yeah. Now the teacher, one thing I always want to say to the teachers is a lot of teachers call them accompaniments, but that mindset doesn't serve them, because really what my patterns are points of departure. And so you play it as written, and then as the student plays, as you're playing a duet with them, you're starting to vary. You're adding a note. You're changing a rhythm. You're blocking it instead of breaking it up, or vice versa. So you're varying it in response to what the student does. So you're not just an accompanist. You're a co-creator.
Right. Good way to think of it. And what about for those teachers who are a little intimidated by teaching improv because they were never brought up with it themselves? Just a couple of tips for them of how to get started and reduce that?
Well, the first thing I would say to them is it's totally natural that you would feel that way, because I have had teachers in my workshop who nearly fainted because it's the first time in 30 years they haven't had a piece of music in front of their face.
You sure just wasn't because they were meeting you, Forrest?
Oh, I doubt it. I'm a nice guy. You know,
going back to Liszt, didn't Liszt make people faint?
But that's because a lot of women wore corsets at the time, and it was kind of a Beatles mania, Liszt mania sort of thing, or, you know, the crowd and all that. But anyway.
Go on.
Now I've forgotten the question.
It was about helping teachers who are intimidated.
Right. Sorry. I was thinking about Liszt mania. First of all, to recognize that you're perfectly natural for feeling this way. It's not a character flaw. It's a result of the way you're trained. The second thing to consider, that if you play duets with your student, it's a great way to learn along with them. And I've had teachers say, but that's not ethical to have students pay me to learn on the job. And I turn that around and I say, on the contrary, you are providing them a wonderful role model of what a living, vital adult should be, somebody who's willing to put the facade down and say, hey, I'm trying something new. You want to try along with me? And boy, does that level the playing field. And the kid relaxes and you learn together. So I always encourage teachers to learn in that way, or to find another teacher and just start playing duets with them.
Lovely. Well said. I think it's a great approach. All right. And what about students who bring in new compositions and creative ideas each lesson, and for teachers who feel out of their depth with how to help them? I've certainly had students do this. Every week they've got a new idea, and it's like, I don't know what to do with this.
Yeah, right. Well, the first thing I would say to teachers is even composers don't know what to do with their ideas. So you shouldn't feel bad about not knowing what to do. I mean, some composer, I forgot who it was, it might have been Hindemith, said, everybody can write four bars, but genius shows up in the fifth bar. And and that's when nobody really knows what to do. So I always tell teachers the best thing you can do is simply help your student explore possibilities. And in other words, your job is not to give them answers. They're the composers. They get to make the decisions. But say a student comes in and the whole piece is with, say in one key, but yet you can tell that the idea wants to go somewhere. So you could say, have you ever considered playing this in another key? And they go, well, what do you mean? And so I would sit down and I play the same thing they just played up a step. They go, oh, that sounds great. And I say, yeah, you could play this idea and then go up a key, up a key, up a key. Or you could, you know, transpose it to another mode. Or, you know, so I basically will spend time showing them some of the hidden possibilities in the idea and let them go home and explore and discover and make the decisions. So it takes the pressure off teachers. They don't have to come up with the answer. They just have to come up with good questions.
I think teachers underestimate their own ability sometimes in these kind of areas.
Yeah.
Most of us are trained. If we're not formally trained, then we're pretty experienced for the most part. And you probably know more about what you could help your student with than you think. So I like that approach. Just ask what if questions and help guide them with suggestions. That's really all you can do.
Tim, I totally agree with you that teachers have heard music their whole lives. They played literature. They have a much deeper sense of what composition is than they consciously know. And if they can just kind of trust their intuition and think that they're exploring with the student instead of being the teacher with the answers, then it can be quite an enjoyable thing.
One of my teenagers came in yesterday, actually, and he's been working on a composition. And he came in and played it, and we discussed really two things. One was his sense of timing. The main part of the composition was in 6/8, clearly a triple feel. The first part moved between 2/4, 4/4, and 5/4. It was just not clear at all. So that was an easy thing for me to suggest. I felt that it didn't sit. The beginning did not feel grounded at all. So I suggested let's explore some different rhythms. Should we do the first part in 3 and the second part in 3, or should we, whatever it was. So that was one approach. And the second one was that he'd chosen to use a series of 6 chords in a progression and repeating it. And it just didn't quite sound, although 6 is fine sometimes, it didn't quite sound for him as a beginner as structured as the music that he was listening to and the music I know he likes. So we went, built out that second progression to 8. And again, you know, it suddenly felt a bit better. And so they were just musical kind of skills that I had that I was able to share with him. But I never told him what to do. It was just like, well, here's another idea. Why don't we try this? And I think that's exactly what you've been saying.
Exactly right. And right. 8 bars, 12 bars, 16 bars, which do you prefer? You know, explore them all. Because ultimately, all musical expressions have some validity to some extent. And the more we explore the options, the clearer we get on what we really want. So I bet after he heard the 8 bars, he said, oh, yeah, that's what I want.
Right, right. And he used all major chords. So we threw in some minors, and suddenly the colors opened up and his eyes opened, and it was like, yep, he's going to go home and have some fun with that this week.
Right. And then the next thing I would maybe say, okay, you've got all these triads, but you know, there's a really nice color that a lot of contemporary composers add. Have you ever added a second to a chord? And the kid says, well, what's a second? Oh, let me show you. The added second makes a major chord sound sweeter, but weirdly enough, it makes a minor chord sound more sour, more minor. So the second's like a flavor enhancer. And, you know, so again, it's a lot of new options, but I just say try it.
Exactly. And for teachers who want to know more about this kind of chordal approach, if you missed my webinar that I did recently, then you can find out more at my website, timtopham.com/chords, where I've got a whole lot of information about my approach and some of these suggestions about adding seconds and suspensions and those kinds of colors that you can easily suggest students add into compositions. And it's not too difficult, even if you've never done it yourself before. Forrest, it's been an absolute pleasure, as always. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, that's fine. No, it has been a pleasure to talk to you. I mean, I feel like we've got a similar mission here, just to encourage teachers to kind of get out of the 19th century and and open up to the whole creative domain that's possible.
100%. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in this podcast and what Forrest has been talking about to certainly follow him on Facebook. And he regularly posts. He's been posting. I mean, that was just one of, I don't know, you've gone a bit bananas in the last few weeks, which has been great, by the way. His last post was like poetry. Like it was just, Shakespeare would have been proud, I think. It wasn't in iambic pentameter, but it was pretty good. So yeah, do follow him on there. And also make sure you check out his latest series of improvising and creativity books. They're called Create First. Forrest, where do people go to find that series?
You know, the only place you can get that is on my website, and that's www.forrestkinney.com. So if you spell my name correctly, you can get to my website. So it's two R's and K-I-N-N-E-Y. I don't sell it anywhere else.
No, I think it's great. You've gone the self-publishing route, and I think it's. I hope it's working out for you. It's great because anyone around the world can download it really, really easily. And you've got a lot of examples and teaching videos. So definitely check out Forrest's site. Yep, forrestkinney.com. Thank you, Forrest. I'm sure our paths will cross again in the near future. I hope it's not too far away because I do enjoy our conversations immensely.
I do too, Tim. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. So reminders for everyone who's enjoyed this episode, you can find out the show notes and links to everything that we've been talking about at timtopham.com/episode104. And a quick reminder too that you can now get updates into your Facebook Messenger directly when I post on the blog or the podcast. If you want to find out how to do that, it's literally one click. Head to timtopham.com/Facebook. Click the blue button and I'll be in your Messenger inbox whenever I update something and provide you some new information. So check that out. And next week, I'm very, very excited. We've got our discussion with the fantastic Deborah Perez all about converting to group piano teaching. If that's something that's been of interest to you, maybe you're in the process, maybe you haven't started, maybe you're just thinking about it, make sure you tune in to our episode next week. That's podcast number 105 with Deborah Perez. Until then, thanks so much for tuning in, everyone, and happy teaching.
Ladies and gentlemen, that will conclude this evening's entertainment.
Oh, thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Piano Teaching Podcast. We'd love to help take your teaching to the next level as a member of our supportive community. Use the coupon PIANOPODCAST for $100 off an annual membership of Tim's Inner Circle today. To find out more, head to timtopham.com/community.